childhood, and he thought it was silly that his father couldn't see it, too. Uncle Morgan was never going to look for a record called Daddy Plays the Horn. He was just flattering Phil Sawyer. And maybe the reason Phil Sawyer didn't see it was that, like everyone else, he never paid quite enough attention to Morgan Sloat. Uncle Morgan, smart and ambitious, smart as a wolverine, sneaky as a courthouse lawyer, Lily said. Good old Uncle Morgan deflected observation. Your eye just sort of naturally slid off him. When he was a kid, Jackie would have bet his teachers would have had trouble even remembering his name. Imagine what this guy would be like over there, Uncle Morgan said, for once fully claiming Jack's attention. That falsity still played through his voice, but it was not Sloat's hypocrisy that jerked up Jackie's head and tightened his fingers on his heavy toy. The words over there had sailed straight into his brain and were now gonging like chimes. Because over there was the country of Jack's daydreams. He had known that immediately. His father and Uncle Morgan had forgotten that he was behind the couch, and they were going to talk about the daydreams. His father knew about the daydream country. Jack could never have mentioned the daydreams to either his father or his mother, but his father knew about the daydreams because he had to. Simple as that. And the next step, felt along Jack's emotions more than consciously expressed, was that his dad helped keep the daydreams safe. But for some reason, equally difficult to translate from emotion into language, the conjunction of Morgan Sloat and the daydreams made the boy uneasy. "Hey," Uncle Morgan said, "this guy would really turn him around, wouldn't he? They'd probably make him Duke of the Blasted Lands or something." "Well, probably not that," Phil Sawyer said. "Not if they liked him as much as we do." "But Uncle Morgan doesn't like him, Dad," Jackie thought, suddenly clear that this was important. "He doesn't like him at all. Not really. He thinks that music is too loud. He thinks it takes something from him." "Oh, you know a lot more about it than I do," Uncle Morgan said, in a voice that sounded easy and relaxed. "Well, I've been there more often, but you're doing a good job at catching up." Jackie heard that his father was smiling. "Oh, I've learned a few things, Phil. But really, you know, I'll never get over being grateful to you for showing all that to me." The two syllables of grateful filled with smoke and the sound of breaking glass. But all of these little warnings could not do more than dent Jack's intense, almost blissful satisfaction. They were talking about the daydreams. It was magical that such a thing was possible. What they said was beyond him. Their terms and vocabulary were too adult, but six-year-old Jack experienced again the wonder and joy of the daydreams, and was at least old enough to understand the direction of their conversation. The daydreams were real, and Jackie somehow shared them with his father. That was half his joy. "Let me just get something straight," Uncle Morgan said, and Jackie saw the word straight as a pair of lines knotting around each other like snakes. "They have magic like we have physics, right? We're talking about an agrarian monarchy using magic instead of science."
"Sure," Phil Sawyer said.
"And, presumably, they've gone on like that for centuries. Their lives have never changed very much."
"Except for political upheavals, that's right."
Then Uncle Morgan's voice tightened, and the excitement he tried to conceal cracked little whips within his consonants. "Well, forget about the political stuff. Suppose we think about us for a change. You'll say, and I'd agree with you, Phil, that we've done pretty well out of the territories already, and that we'd have to be careful about how we introduce changes there. I have no problem at all with that position. I feel the same way myself."
Jackie could feel his father's silence.
"Okay," Sloat continued. "Let's go with the concept that, within a situation basically advantageous to ourselves, we can spread the benefits around to anybody on our side. We don't sacrifice the advantage, but we're not greedy about the bounty it brings. We owe these people, Phil. Look what they've done for us. I think we could put ourselves into a really synergistic situation over there. Our energy can feed their energy and come up with stuff we've never even thought of, Phil, and we end up looking generous, which we are, but which also doesn't hurt us." He would be frowning forward, the palms of his hands pressed together. Of course, I don't have a total window on this situation, you know that, but I think the synergy alone is worth the price of admission, to tell you the truth. But, Phil, can you imagine how much fucking clout we'd swing if we gave them electricity? If we got modern weapons to the right guys over there? Do you have any idea? I think it'd be awesome. Awesome!
The damp, squashy sound of his clapping hands. I don't want to catch you unprepared or anything, but I thought it might be time for us to think along those lines. To think, territories-wise, about increasing our involvement. Phil Sawyer still said nothing. Uncle Morgan slapped his hands together again. Finally, Phil Sawyer said in a noncommittal voice, "You want to think about increasing our involvement?"
"I think it's the way to go. And I can give you chapter and verse, Phil, but I shouldn't have to. You can probably remember as well as I can what it was like before we started going there together. Hey, maybe we could have made it all on our own, and maybe we would have. But as for me, I'm grateful not to be representing a couple of broken-down strippers and little Timmy Tiptoe anymore."
"Hold on," Jack's father said.
"Airplanes," Uncle Morgan said. "Think airplanes."
"Hold on, hold on there, Morgan. I have a lot of ideas that apparently have yet to occur to you."
"I'm always ready for new ideas," Morgan said, and his voice was smoky again.
"Okay, I think we have to be careful about what we do over there, partner. I think anything major, any real changes we bring about, just might turn around and bite our asses back here. Everything has consequences, and some of those consequences might be on the uncomfortable side."
"Like what?" Uncle Morgan asked.
"Like war."
"That's nuts, Phil. We've never seen anything, unless you mean Bledsoe."
"I do mean Bledsoe. Was that a coincidence?"
"Bledsoe?" Jack wondered.
He had heard the name before, but it was vague.
"Well, that's a long way from war, to put it mildly, and I don't concede the connection anyhow."
"All right. Do you remember hearing about how a stranger assassinated the old king over there a long time ago? You ever hear about that?"
"Yeah, I suppose," Uncle Morgan said, and Jack heard again the falseness in his voice.
His father's chair squeaked. He was taking his feet off his desk, leaning forward. "The assassination touched off a minor war over there. The followers of the old king had to put down a rebellion led by a couple of disgruntled nobles. These guys saw their chance to take over and run things, seize lands, impound property, throw their enemies in jail, make themselves rich."
"Hey, be fair," Morgan broke in. "I heard about this stuff, too. They also wanted to bring some kind of political order to a crazy, inefficient system. Sometimes you have to be tough starting out. I can see that."
"And it's not for us to make judgments about their politics, I agree, but here's my point. That little war over there lasted about 3 weeks. When it was over, maybe 100 people had been killed. Fewer, probably. Did anyone ever tell you when that war began? What year it was? What day?"
"No," Uncle Morgan muttered in a sulky voice.
"It was the 1st of September, 1939. Over here, it was the day Germany invaded Poland." His father stopped talking, and Jackie, clutching his black toy taxi behind the couch, yawned silently but hugely.
"That screwball," Uncle Morgan finally said. "Their war started ours? Do you really believe that?"
"I do believe that," Jack's father said. "I believe a 3-week squabble over there in some way sparked off a war here that lasted 6 years and killed millions of people, yes."
"Well," Uncle Morgan said, and Jack could see him beginning to huff and blow.
"There's more. I've talked to lots of people over there about this, and the feeling I get is that the stranger who assassinated the king was a real stranger, if you see what I mean. Those who saw him got the feeling that he was uncomfortable with territory's clothes. He acted like he was unsure of local customs. He didn't understand the money right away."
"Ah.
Yes. If they hadn't torn him to pieces right after he stuck a knife into the king, we could be sure about this. But I'm sure anyhow that he was...
like us.
Like us.
That's right. A visitor. Morgan, I don't think we can mess around too much over there, because we simply don't know what the effects will be. To tell you the truth, I think we're affected all the time by things that go on in the territories. And should I tell you another crazy thing?
Why not? Sloat answered.
That's not the only other world out there.
Bullshit, Sloat said.
I mean it. I've had the feeling once or twice when I was there that I was near to somewhere else, the territory's territories.
Yes, Jack thought, that's right. It has to be. The daydream's daydreams, someplace even more beautiful. And on the other side of that is the daydream's daydreams, daydreams, and on the other side of that is another place, another world, nicer still.
He realized for the first time that he had become very sleepy. The daydream's daydreams. And then he was almost immediately asleep, the heavy little taxi in his lap, his whole body simultaneously weighty with sleep, anchored to the strip of wooden floor, and so blissfully light. The conversation must have continued. There must have been much that Jackie missed. He rose and fell, heavy and light, through the second hole side of Daddy Plays the Horn, and during that time Morgan Sloat must at first have argued, gently, but with what squeezings of his fists, what contortions of his forehead, for his plan. Then he must have allowed himself to seem persuadable, then finally persuaded by his partner's doubts. At the end of this conversation, which returned to the 12-year-old Jackie Sawyer in the dangerous borderland between Oatley, New York, and a nameless territory's village, Morgan Sloat had allowed himself to seem not only persuaded, but positively grateful for the lessons. When Jack woke up, the first thing he heard was his father asking, "Hey, did Jack disappear or something?" And the second thing was Uncle Morgan saying, "Hell, I guess you're right, Phil. You have a way of seeing right to the heart of things. You're great the way you do that." "Where the hell is Jack?" his father said. And Jack stirred behind the couch, really waking up now. The black taxi thudded to the floor.
"Aha," Uncle Morgan said. "Little pitchers and big ears, peut-être?"
"You behind there, kiddo?" his father said. Noises of chairs pushing back across the wooden floor, of men standing up. He said, "Ooh," and slowly lifted the taxi back into his lap. His legs felt stiff and uncomfortable. When he stood, they would tingle. His father laughed. Footsteps came toward him. Morgan Sloat's red, puffy face appeared over the top of the couch. Jack yawned and pushed his knees into the back of the couch. His father's face appeared beside Sloat's. His father was smiling. For a moment, both of those grown-up adult male heads seemed to be floating over the top of the couch. "Let's move on home, sleepyhead," his father said. When the boy looked into Uncle Morgan's face, he saw calculations sink into his skin, slide underneath his jolly fat man's cheeks like a snake beneath a rock. He looked like Richard Sloat's daddy again, like good old Uncle Morgan who always gave spectacular Christmas and birthday presents, like good old sweaty Uncle Morgan so easy not to notice. But what did he look like before? Like a human earthquake, like a man crumbling apart over the fault line behind his eyes, like something all wound up and waiting to explode.
"How about a little ice cream on the way home, Jack?" Uncle Morgan said to him. "That sound good to you?"
"Ah," Jack said.
"Yeah, we can stop off at that place in the lobby," his father said. "Yummy, yum, yum," Uncle Morgan said. "Now we're really talking about synergy." And smiled at Jack once more.
This happened when he was 6, and in the midst of his weightless tumble through limbo, it happened again. The horrible purple taste of Speedy's juice backed up into his mouth, into the passages behind his nose, and all of that languid afternoon of 6 years before replayed itself out in his mind. He saw it just as if the magic juice brought total recall, and so speedily that he lived through that afternoon in the same few seconds which told him that this time the magic juice really was going to make him vomit. Uncle Morgan's eyes smoking, and inside Jack a question smoking too, demanding to finally come out. Who played What changes? What changes? Who plays those changes, Daddy? Who killed Jerry Bledsoe? The magic juice forced itself into the boy's mouth. Stinging threads of it nauseatingly trickled into his nose, and just as Jack felt loose earth beneath his hands, he gave up and vomited rather than drown. What killed Jerry Bledsoe? Foul, purple stuff shot from Jack's mouth, choking him, and he blindly pushed himself backward, his feet and legs snagged in tall, stiff weeds. Jack pushed himself up on his hands and knees and waited, patient as a mule, his mouth drooping open, for the second attack. His stomach clenched, and he did not have time to groan before more of the stinking juice burned up through his chest and throat and spattered out of his mouth. Ropey pink strings of saliva hung from his lips, and Jack feebly brushed them away. He wiped his hand on his pants. Jerry Bledsoe, yes, Jerry, who'd always had his name spelled out on his shirt like a gas station attendant. Jerry, who had died when... The boy shook his head and wiped his hands across his mouth again. He spat into a nest of saw-toothed wild grass, sprouting like a giant's corsage out of the gray-brown earth. Some dim animal instinct he did not understand made him push loose earth over the pinkish pool of vomit. Another reflex made him brush the palms of his hands against his trousers. Finally, he looked up. He was kneeling, in the last of the evening light, on the edge of a dirt lane. No horrible Elroy thing pursued him. He had known that immediately. Dogs penned in a wooden, cage-like enclosure barked and snarled at him, thrusting their snouts through the cracks of their jail. On the other side of the fenced-in dogs was a rambling wooden structure, and from here, too, doggy noises rose up into the immense sky. These were unmistakably similar to the noises Jack had just been hearing from the other side of a wall in the Oatley Tap, the sounds of drunken men bellowing at each other. A bar. Here it would be an inn or a public house, Jack imagined. Now that he was no longer sickened by Speedy's juice, he could smell the pervasive, yeasty odors of malt and hops. He could not let the men from the inn discover him. For a moment he imagined himself running from all those dogs, yipping and growling through the cracks in their enclosure, and then he stood up. The sky seemed to tilt over his head, to darken. And back home, in his world, what was happening? A nice little disaster in the middle of Oatley? Maybe a nice little flood? A sweet little fire? Jack slipped quietly backward away from the inn, then began to move sideways through the tall grass. Perhaps 60 yards away, thick candles burned in the windows of the only other building he could see. From somewhere not far off to his right drifted the odor of pigs. When Jack had gone half the distance between the inn and the house, the dogs ceased growling and snapping, and he slowly began walking forward toward the western road. The night was dark and moonless. Jerry Bledsoe. There were other houses, though Jack did not see them until he was nearly before them. Except for the noisy drinkers behind him at the inn, here in the country, territory's people went to bed when the sun did. No candles burned in these small, square windows. Themselves squarish and dark, the houses on either side of the western road sat in a puzzling isolation. Something was wrong, as in a visual game from a child's magazine, but Jack could not identify it. Nothing hung upside down, nothing burned, nothing seemed extravagantly out of place. Most of the houses had thick, fuzzy roofs, which resembled haystacks with crew cuts, but Jack assumed that these were thatch. He had heard of it, but never seen it before. Morgan, he thought with a sudden thrill of panic. Morgan of Oris, and saw the two of them, the man with long hair and a built-up boot, and his father's sweaty, workaholic partner, for a moment jumbled up together. Morgan sloat with pirate's hair and a hitch in his walk. But Morgan, this world's Morgan, was not what was wrong with this picture. Jack was just now passing a short, squat, one-story building, like an inflated rabbit hutch, crazily half-timbered with wide, black wooden X's. A fuzzy, crew-cut thatch capped this building, too. If he were walking out of Oatley, or even running out of Oatley, to be closer to the truth, what would he expect to see in the single dark window of this hutch for giant rabbits? He knew. The dancing glimmer of a television screen. But of course, Territory's houses did not have television sets inside them, and the absence of that colorful glimmer was not what had puzzled him. It was something else, something so much an aspect of any grouping of houses along a road that its absence left a hole in the landscape. You noticed the hole even if you could not quite identify what was absent. Television, television sets. Jack continued past the half-timbered little building and saw ahead of him, its front door set only inches back from the verge of the road, another gnomishly small dwelling. This one seemed to have a sod, not a thatched roof, and Jack smiled to himself. This tiny village had reminded him of Hobbiton. Would a hobbit cable stringer pull up here and say to the lady of the shack, doghouse, "Anyhow, would he say, 'Ma'am, we're installing cable in your area, and for a small monthly fee, hitch you up right now. You get 15 new channels, you get Midnight Blue, you get the all-sports and all-weather channels, you get—'" And that, he suddenly realized, was it. In front of these houses were no poles, no wiring. No TV antennas complicated the sky, no tall wooden poles marched the length of the western road, because in the territories there was no electricity. Which was why he had not permitted himself to identify the absent element. Jerry Bledsoe had been, at least part of the time, Sawyer and Sloat's electrician and handyman. When his father and Morgan Sloat used that name, Bledsoe, he thought he had never heard it before. Though, having remembered it, he must have heard the handyman's last name once or twice. But Jerry Bledsoe was almost always just Jerry, as it said above the pocket on his work shirt. "Can't Jerry do something about the air conditioning? Get Jerry to oil the hinges on that door, will you? The squeaks are driving me batshit." And Jerry would appear, his work clothes clean and pressed, his thinning rust-red hair combed flat, his glasses round and earnest, and quietly fix whatever was wrong. There was a Mrs. Jerry who kept the creases sharp and clean in the tan work pants, and several small Jerrys, whom Sawyer and Sloat invariably remembered at Christmas. Jack had been small enough to associate the name Jerry with Tom Cat's eternal adversary, and so imagined that the handyman and Mrs. Jerry and the little Jerrys lived in a giant mouse hole, accessible by a curved arch cut into a baseboard. But who had killed Jerry Bledsoe? His father and Morgan Sloat, always so sweet to the Bledsoe children at Christmas time? Jack stepped forward into the darkness of the western road, wishing that he had forgotten completely about Sawyer and Sloat's handyman, that he had fallen asleep as soon as he had crawled behind the couch. Sleep was what he wanted now, wanted it far more than the uncomfortable thoughts which that 6 years dead conversation had aroused in him. Jack promised himself that as soon as he was sure he was at least a couple of miles past the last house, he would find some place to sleep. A field would do, even a ditch. His legs did not want to move anymore. All his muscles, even his bones, seemed twice their weight. It had been just after one of those times when Jack had wandered into some enclosed place after his father and found that Phil Sawyer had somehow contrived a disappearance. Later, his father would manage to vanish from his bedroom, from the dining room, from the conference room at Sawyer and Sloat. On this occasion, he executed his mystifying trick in the garage beside the house on Rodeo Drive. Jack, sitting unobserved on the little knob of raised land, which was the closest thing to a hill offered by this section of Beverly Hills, saw his father leave their house by the front door, cross the lawn while digging in his pockets for money or keys, and let himself into the garage by the side door. The white door on the right side should have swung up seconds later, but it remained stubbornly closed. Then Jack realized that his father's car was where it had been all this Saturday morning, parked at the curb directly in front of the house. Lily's car was gone. She'd plugged a cigarette into her mouth and announced that she was taking herself off to a screening of Dirt Track, the latest film by the director of Death's Darling, and nobody by God had better try to stop her, and so the garage was empty. For minutes, Jack waited for something to happen. Neither the side door nor the big front doors opened. Eventually, Jack slid down off the grassy elevation, went to the garage, and let himself in. The wide, familiar space was entirely empty. Dark oil stains patterned the gray cement floor, tools hung from silver hooks set into the walls. Jack grunted in astonishment, called out, "Dad!" and looked at everything again, just to make sure. This time he saw a cricket hop toward the shadowy protection of a wall, and for a second almost could have believed that magic was real and some malign wizard had happened along and... The cricket reached the wall and slipped into an invisible crack. No, his father had not been turned into a cricket. Of course he had not. "Hey," the boy said, to himself, it seemed. He walked backward to the side door and left the garage. Sunlight fell on the lush, springy lawns of Rodeo Drive. He would have called someone, but whom? The police? "My daddy walked into the garage and I couldn't find him in there, and now I'm scared." 2 hours later, Phil Sawyer came walking up from the Beverly Wilshire end of the street. He carried his jacket over his shoulder, had pulled down the knot of his tie. To Jack, he looked like a man returning from a journey around the world. Jack jumped down from his anxious elevation and tore toward his father. "You sure cover the ground," his father said, smiling, and Jack flattened himself against his legs. "I thought you were taking a nap, traveling Jack." They heard the telephone ringing as they came up the walk, and some instinct, perhaps the instinct to keep his father close, made Jackie pray that it had already rung a dozen times, that whoever was calling would hang up before they reached the front door. His father ruffled the hair on his crown, put his big warm hand on the back of his neck, then pulled open the door and made it to the phone in 5 long strides. "Yes, Morgan," Jackie heard his father say. "Oh? Bad news? You'd better tell me, yes." After a long moment of silence, in which the boy could hear the tinny, rasping sound of Morgan Sloat's voice stealing through the telephone wires, "Oh, Jerry! My God, poor Jerry! I'll be right over." Then his father looked straight at him, not smiling, not winking, not doing anything but taking him in. "I'll come over, Morgan. I'll have to bring Jack, but he can wait in the car." Jack felt his muscles relax, and was so relieved that he did not ask why he had to wait in the car, as he would have at any other time. Phil drove up Rodeo Drive to the Beverly Hills Hotel, turned left onto Sunset, and pointed the car toward the office building. He said nothing. His father zipped through the oncoming traffic and swung the car into the parking lot beside the office building. Already in the lot were 2 police cars, a fire truck, Uncle Morgan's pocket-sized white Mercedes convertible, the rusted old Plymouth 2-door that had been the handyman's car. Just inside the entrance, Uncle Morgan was talking to a policeman who shook his head slowly, slowly, in evident sympathy. Morgan Sloat's right arm squeezed the shoulders of a slim young woman in a dress too large for her who had twisted her face into his chest. Mrs. Jerry, Jack knew, seeing that most of her face was obscured by a white handkerchief she had pressed to her eyes. A behatted, rain-coated fireman pushed a mess of twisted metal and plastic, ashes and broken glass into a disorderly heap far past them down the hall. Phil said, "Just sit here for a minute or two, okay, Jackie?" and sprinted toward the entrance. A young Chinese woman sat talking to a policeman on a concrete abutment at the end of the parking lot. Before her lay a crumpled object it took Jack a moment to recognize as a bike. When Jack inhaled, he smelled bitter smoke. 20 minutes later, both his father and Uncle Morgan left the building. Still gripping Mrs. Jerry, Uncle Morgan waved goodbye to the Sawyers. He led the woman around to the passenger door of his tiny car. Jack's father twirled his own car out of the lot and back into the traffic on Sunset. "Is Jerry hurt?" Jack asked. "Some kind of freak accident," his father said. "Electricity, the whole building could have gone up in smoke." "Is Jerry hurt?" Jack repeated. "Poor son of a bitch got hurt so bad he's dead," said his father. Jack and Richard Sloat needed 2 months to really put the story together out of the conversations they overheard. Jack's mother and Richard's housekeeper supplied other details, the housekeeper the goriest. Jerry Bledsoe had come in on a Saturday to try to iron out some of the kinks in the building security system. If he tampered with the delicate system on a weekday, he was sure to confuse or irritate the tenants with the klaxon alarm whenever he accidentally set it off. The security system was wired into the building's main electrical board, set behind two large removable walnut panels on the ground floor. Jerry had set down his tools and lifted off the panels, having already seen that the lot was empty and nobody would jump out of his skin when the alarm went off. Then he went downstairs to the telephone in his basement cubicle and told the local precinct house to ignore any signals from the Sawyer and Sloat address until his next telephone call. When he went back upstairs to tackle the mare's nest of wires coming into the board from all the contact points, a 23-year-old woman named Lorette Chang was just riding her bicycle into the building's lot. She was distributing a leaflet advertising a restaurant which was due to open down the street in 15 days. Miss Chang later told the police that she looked through the glass front door and saw a workman enter the hall from the basement. Just before the workman picked up his screwdriver and touched the wiring panel, she felt the parking lot wobble beneath her feet. It was, she assumed, a mini earthquake. A lifelong resident of Los Angeles, Lorette Chang was untroubled by any seismic event that did not actually knock anything down. She saw Jerry Bledsoe set his feet, so he felt it too, though no one else did, shake his head, then gently insert the tip of the screwdriver into a hive of wires. And then the entry and downstairs corridor of the Sawyer and Sloat building turned into a holocaust. The entire wiring panel turned instantly to a solid rectangular body of flame. Bluish-yellow arcs of what looked like lightning shot out and encased the workman. Electronic horns bawled and bawled. Kawam! Kawam! A ball of fire 6 feet high fell right out of the wall, slammed the already dead Jerry Bledsoe aside, and rolled down the corridor toward the lobby. The transparent front door blew into flying glass and smoking twisted pieces of frame. Lorette Chang dropped her bike and sprinted toward the pay telephone across the street. As she told the fire department the building's address and noticed that her bicycle had been twisted neatly in half by whatever force had burst through the door, Jerry Bledsoe's roasted corpse still swayed upright back and forth before the devastated panel. Thousands of volts poured through his body, twitching it with regular surges, snapping it back and forth in a steady pulse. All the handyman's body hair and most of his clothes had fried off, and his skin had become a cooked, blotchy gray. His eyeglasses, a solidifying lump of brown plastic, covered his nose like a poultice. Jerry Bledsoe. Who plays those changes, Daddy? Jack made his feet move until he had gone half an hour without seeing another of the little thatched cottages. Unfamiliar stars in unfamiliar patterns lay all over the sky above him. Messages in a language he could not read. Chapter 12. Jack Goes to the Market. He slept that night in a sweetly fragrant Territories haystack, first burrowing his way in and then turning around so the fresh air could reach him along the tunnel he had made. He listened apprehensively for small scuttering sounds. He had heard or read somewhere that field mice were great haystack fans. If they were in this one, then a great big mouse named Jack Sawyer had scared them into silence. He relaxed, little by little, his left hand tracing the shape of Speedy's bottle. He had plugged the top with a piece of springy moss from a small stream where he had stopped to drink. He supposed it was entirely possible that some of the moss would fall into the bottle, or already had. What a pity! It would spoil the piquant flavor and the delicate bouquet. As he lay in here, warm, at last, heavily sleepy, the feeling he was most aware of was relief, as if there had been a dozen 10-pound weights strapped to his back and some kind soul had undone the buckles and allowed them to fall to the ground. He was in the Territories again, the place which such charming folks as Morgan of Orris, Osmond the Bullwhipper, and Elroy the Amazing Goat Man all called home, the Territories where anything could happen. But the Territories could be good, too. He remembered that from his earliest childhood, when everyone had lived in California and no one had lived anyplace else.
The territories could be good, and it seemed he felt that goodness around him now, as calmly, inarguably sweet as the smell of a haystack, as clear as the smell of the territory's air. Does a fly or a ladybug feel relief if an unexpected gust of wind comes along and tilts the pitcher plant just enough to allow the drowning insect to fly out? Jack didn't know. But he knew that he was out of Oatley, away from fair weather clubs and old men who wept over their stolen shopping carts, away from the smell of beer and the smell of puke. Most important of all, he was away from Smoky Updike and the Oatley Tap. He thought he might travel in the territories for a while, after all. And so thinking, fell asleep. He had walked 2, perhaps 3 miles along the western road the following morning, enjoying the sunshine and the good earthy smell of fields almost ready for the harvests of summer's end, when a cart pulled over and a whiskery farmer, in what looked like a toga with rough breeches under it, pulled up and shouted, "Are you for Market Town, boy?" Jack gaped at him, half in a panic, realizing that the man was not speaking English. Never mind prithee or dost thou go cross-guarded, varlet, it wasn't English at all. There was a woman in a voluminous dress sitting beside the whiskery farmer. She held a boy of perhaps 3 on her lap. She smiled pleasantly enough at Jack and rolled her eyes at her husband. "He's a simpleton, Henry. They're not speaking English. But whatever it is they're speaking, I understand it. I'm actually thinking in that language, and that's not all I'm seeing in it, or with it, or whatever it is I mean." Jack realized he had been doing it the last time he had been in the territories, too. Only then he had been too confused to realize it. Things had moved too fast, and everything had seemed strange. The farmer leaned forward. He smiled, showing teeth which were absolutely horrid. "Are you a simpleton, laddie?" he asked, not unkindly. "No," he said, smiling back as best he could, aware that he had not said no, but some territory's word which meant no. When he had flipped, he had changed his speech and his way of thinking, his way of imaging, anyway. He did not have that word in his vocabulary, but understood what he meant just the same, just as he had changed his clothes. "I'm not simple. It's just that my mother told me to be careful of people I might meet along the road." Now the farmer's wife smiled. "Your mother was right," she said. "Are you for the market?" "Yes," Jack said. "That is, I'm headed up the road, west." "Climb up in the back, then," Henry the farmer said. "Daylight's wasting. I want to sell what I have if I can and be home again before sunset. Corn's poor, but it's the last of the season. Lucky to have corn in 9 months at all. Someone may buy it." "Thank you," Jack said, climbing into the back of the low wagon. Here dozens of corn were bound with rough hanks of rope and stacked like cordwood. If the corn was poor, then Jack could not imagine what would constitute good corn over here. They were the biggest ears he had ever seen in his life. There were also small stacks of squashes and gourds and things that looked like pumpkins, but they were reddish instead of orange. Jack didn't know what they were, but he suspected they would taste wonderful. His stomach rumbled busily. Since going on the road, he had discovered what hunger was, not as a passing acquaintance, something you felt dimly after school and which could be assuaged with a few cookies and a glass of milk souped up with Nestle's Quick, but as an intimate friend, one that sometimes moved away to a distance, but who rarely left entirely. He was sitting with his back to the front of the wagon, his sandal-clad feet dangling down, almost touching the hard-packed dirt of the western road. There was a lot of traffic this morning, most of it bound for the market, Jack assumed. Every now and then Henry bawled a greeting to someone he knew. Jack was still wondering how those apple-colored pumpkins might taste, and just where his next meal was going to come from anyway, when small hands twined in his hair and gave a brisk tug, brisk enough to make his eyes water. He turned and saw the 3-year-old standing there in his bare feet, a big grin on his face, and a few strands of Jack's hair in each of his hands. "Jason," his mother cried, but it was in its way an indulgent cry. "Did you see the way he pulled that hair? My, isn't he strong? Jason, that's not nice." Jason grinned, unabashed.
It was a big, dopey, sunshiny grin, as sweet in its way as the smell of the haystack in which Jack had spent the night. He couldn't help returning it, and while there had been no politics of calculation in his returning grin, he saw he had made a friend of Henry's wife. "Sit," Jason said, swaying back and forth with the unconscious movement of a veteran sailor. He was still grinning at Jack.
"Huh?" "Yap."
"I'm not getting you, Jason."
"Sit, yap."
"I'm not," and then Jason, who was husky for a 3-year-old, plopped into Jack's lap, still grinning. "Sit, yap. Oh, yeah, I get it," Jack thought, feeling the dull ache from his testicles spreading up into the pit of his stomach. "Jason, bad," his mother called back, in that same indulgent but isn't he cute voice. And Jason, who knew who ruled the roost, grinned his dopey, sweetly charming grin. Jack realized that Jason was wet. Very, extremely, indubitably wet. "Welcome back to the territories, Jacko." And sitting there with the child in his arms and warm wetness slowly soaking through his clothes, Jack began to laugh, his face turned up to the blue, blue sky. A few minutes later, Henry's wife worked her way to where Jack was sitting with the child on his lap and took Jason back.
"Ooh, wet, bad baby," she said in her indulgent voice.
"Doesn't my Jason wet big," Jack thought, and laughed again. That made Jason laugh, and Mrs. Henry laughed with them. As she changed Jason, she asked Jack a number of questions, ones he had heard often enough in his own world. But here he would have to be careful. He was a stranger, and there might be hidden trap doors. He heard his father telling Morgan, "a real stranger, if you see what I mean." Jack sensed that the woman's husband was listening closely. He answered her questions with a careful variation of the story, not the one he told when he was applying for a job, but the one he told when someone who had picked him up thumbing got curious. He said he had come from the village of All Hands. Jason's mother had a vague recollection of hearing of the place, but that was all. Had he really come so far, she wanted to know. Jack told her that he had. And where was he going? He told her, and the silently listening Henry, that he was bound for the village of California. That one she had not heard of, even vaguely, in such stories as the occasional peddler told. Jack was not exactly very surprised, but he was grateful that neither of them exclaimed, "California? Who ever heard of a village named California? Who are you trying to shuck and jive, boy?" In the territories, there had to be lots of places, whole areas as well as villages, of which people who lived in their own little areas had never heard. No power poles, no electricity, no movies, no cable TV to tell them how wonderful things were in Malibu or Sarasota. No territory's version of Ma Bell, advertising that a 3-minute call to the outpost after 5 p.m. cost only $5.83, plus tax, rates may be higher on God Pounder's Eve and some other holidays. They live in a mystery, he thought. When you live in a mystery, you don't question a village simply because you've never heard of it. California doesn't sound any wilder than a place named All Hands. Nor did they question. He told them that his father had died the year before and that his mother was quite ill. He thought of adding that the Queen's repossession men had come in the middle of the night and taken away their donkey, grinned, and decided that maybe he ought to leave that part out. His mother had given him what money she could, except the word that came out in the strange language wasn't really money, it was something like sticks, and had sent him off to the village of California to stay with his Aunt Helen. "These are hard times," Mrs. Henry said, holding Jason, now changed, more closely to her. "All Hands is near the Summer Palace, isn't it, boy?" It was the first time Henry had spoken since inviting Jack aboard. "Yes," Jack said. "That is fairly near. I mean, you never said what your father died of." Now he had turned his head. His gaze was narrow and assessing, the former kindness gone. It had been blown out of his eyes like candle flames in a wind. Yes, there were trapdoors here. "Was he ill?" Mrs. Henry asked. "So much illness these days. Pox, plague, hard times." For a wild moment, Jack thought of saying, "No, he wasn't ill, Mrs. Henry. He took a lot of volts, my dad. You see, he went off one Saturday to do some work, and he left Mrs. Jerry and all the little Jerrys, including me, back at home. This was when we all lived in a hole in the baseboard, and nobody lived anywhere else, you see. And do you know what? He stuck his screwdriver into a bunch of wires, and Mrs. Feeney, she works over at Richard Sloat's house, she heard Uncle Morgan talking on the phone, and he said the electricity came out, all of the electricity, and it cooked him. It cooked him so bad that his glasses melted all over his nose. Only you don't know about glasses because you don't have them here. No glasses, no electricity, no midnight blue, no airplanes. Don't end up like Mrs. Jerry, Mrs. Henry. Don't never mind was he ill, the whiskered farmer said. Was he political? Jack looked at him. His mouth was working, but no sounds came out. He didn't know what to say. There were too many trap doors. Henry nodded as if he had answered. Jump down, laddie. Market's just over the next rise. I reckon you can ankle it from here, can't you? Yes, Jack said. I reckon I can. Mrs. Henry looked confused, but she was now holding Jason away from Jack, as if he might have some contagious disease. The farmer, still looking back over his shoulder, smiled a bit ruefully. I'm sorry. You seem a nice enough lad, but we're simple people here. Whatever is going on back yonder by the sea is something for great lords to settle. Either the queen will die or she won't. And, of course, some day she must. God pounds all his nails sooner or later. And what happens to little people when they meddle into the affairs of the great is that they get hurt. My father... I don't want to know about your father, Henry said sharply. His wife scrambled away from Jack, still holding Jason to her bosom. Good man or bad, I don't know and I don't want to know. All I know is that he's a dead man. I don't think you lied about that, and that his son has been sleeping rough and has all the smell of being on the dodge. The son doesn't talk as if he comes from any of these parts, so climb down. I've a son of my own, as you see. Jack got down, sorry for the fear in the young woman's face, fear he had put there. The farmer was right. Little people had no business meddling in the affairs of the great. Not if they were smart. Chapter 13 The Men in the Sky. It was a shock to discover that the money he had worked so hard to get literally had turned into sticks. They looked like toy snakes made by an inept craftsman. The shock lasted only for a moment, however, and he laughed ruefully at himself. The sticks were money, of course. When he came over here, everything changed. Silver dollar to griffin coin, shirt to jerkin, English to territory speech, and good old American money to, well, to jointed sticks. He had flipped over with about $22 in all, and he guessed that he had exactly the same amount in territory's money, although he had counted 14 joints on one of the money sticks and better than 20 on the other. The problem wasn't so much money as cost. He had very little idea of what was cheap and what was dear, and as he walked through the market, Jack felt like a contestant on the new Price is Right. Only if he flubbed it here, there wouldn't be any consolation prize and a clap on the back from Bob Barker. If he flubbed it here, they might... Well, he didn't know for sure what they might do. Run him out for sure. Hurt him? Rough him up? Maybe. Kill him? Probably not, but it was impossible to be absolutely certain. They were little people. They were not political. And he was a stranger. Jack walked slowly from one end of the loud and busy market day throng to the other, wrestling with the problem. It now centered mostly in his stomach. He was dreadfully hungry. Once he saw Henry dickering with a man who had goats to sell. Mrs. Henry stood near him, but a bit behind, giving the men room to trade. Her back was to Jack, but she had the baby hoisted in her arms. Jason, one of the little Henrys, Jack thought. But Jason saw him. The baby waved one chubby hand at Jack, and Jack turned away quickly, putting as much crowd as he could between himself and the Henrys. Everywhere was the smell of roasting meat, it seemed. He saw vendors slowly turning joints of beef over charcoal fires, both small and ambitious. He saw apprentices laying thick slices of what looked like pork on slabs of homemade bread and taking them to the buyers. They looked like runners at an auction. Most of the buyers were farmers like Henry, and it appeared that they also called for food the way people entered a bid at an auction. They simply raised one of their hands imperiously, the fingers splayed out. Jack watched several of these transactions closely, and in every case the medium of exchange was the jointed sticks. But how many knuckles would be enough, he wondered. Not that it mattered. He had to eat, whether the transaction marked him as a stranger or not. He passed a mime show, barely giving it a glance, although the large audience that had gathered, women and children most of them, roared with appreciative laughter and applauded. He moved toward a stall with canvas sides, where a big man with tattoos on his slabbed biceps stood on one side of a trench of smoldering charcoal in the earth. An iron spit about 7 feet long ran over the charcoal. A sweating, dirty boy stood at each end. 5 large roasts were impaled along the length of the spit, and the boys were turning them in unison. "Fine meats," the big man was droning, "fine meats, fine meats, buy my fine meats here, fine meats right here," in an aside to the boy closest to him, "put your back into it, God pound you," then back to his droning, huckstering cry. A farmer, passing with his adolescent daughter, raised his hand and then pointed at the joint of meat second from the left. The boys stopped turning the spit long enough for their boss to hack a slab from the roast and put it on a chunk of bread. One of them ran with it to the farmer, who produced one of the jointed sticks. Watching closely, Jack saw him break off 2 knuckles of wood and hand them to the boy. As the boy ran back to the stall, the customer pocketed his money stick with the absent but careful gesture of any man repocketing his change, took a gigantic bite of his open-faced sandwich, and handed the rest to his daughter, whose first chomp was almost as enthusiastic as her father's. Jack's stomach boinged and goinged. He had seen what he had to see. He hoped. "Fine meats, fine meats, fine—" The big man broke off and looked down at Jack, his beetling brows drawing together over eyes that were small but not entirely stupid. "I hear the song your stomach is singing, friend. If you have money, I'll take your trade and bless you to God in my prayers tonight. If you haven't, then get your stupid sheep's face out of here and go to the devil." Both boys laughed, although they were obviously tired. They laughed as if they had no control over the sounds they were making. But the maddening smell of the slowly cooking meat would not let him leave. He held out the shorter of his jointed sticks and pointed to the roast, which was second from the left. He didn't speak. It seemed safer not to. The vendor grunted, produced his crude knife from his wide belt again, and cut a slice. It was a smaller slice than the one he had cut the farmer, Jack observed, but his stomach had no business with such matters. It was rumbling crazily in anticipation. The vendor slapped the meat on bread and brought it over himself instead of handing it to either of the boys. He took Jack's money stick. Instead of 2 knuckles, he broke off 3. His mother's voice, sourly amused, spoke up in his mind. "Congratulations, Jacko. You've just been screwed." The vendor was looking at him, grinning around a mouthful of wretched, blackish teeth, daring him to say anything, to protest in any way. "You ought to just be grateful I only took 3 knuckles instead of all 14 of them. I could have, you know. You might as well have a sign hung around your neck, boy. I am a stranger here and on my own. So tell me, sheep's face, do you want to make an issue of it?" What he wanted didn't matter. He obviously couldn't make an issue of it. But he felt that thin, impotent anger again. "Go on," the vendor said, tiring of him. He flapped a big hand in Jack's face. His fingers were scarred, and there was blood under his nails. "You got your food? Now get out of here." Jack thought, "I could show you a flashlight, and you'd run like all the devils of hell were after you. Show you an airplane, and you'd probably go crazy. You're maybe not as tough as you think, chum." He smiled. Perhaps there was something in his smile that the meat vendor didn't like, because he drew away from Jack, his face momentarily uneasy. Then his brows beetled together again. "Get out, I said," he roared. "Get out, God pound you!" And this time Jack went. The meat was delicious. Jack gobbled it and the bread it sat on,
and then unselfconsciously licked the juice from his palms as he strolled along. The meat did taste like pork, and yet it didn't. It was somehow richer, tangier than pork. Whatever it was, it filled the hole in the middle of him with authority. Jack thought he could take it to school in bag lunches for 1,000 years. Now that he had managed to shut his belly up, for a little while anyway, he was able to look about himself with more interest, and although he didn't know it, he had finally begun to blend into the crowd. Now he was only one more rube from the country come to the market town, walking slowly between the stalls, trying to gawk in every direction at once. Hucksters recognized him, but only as one more potential mark among many. They yelled and beckoned at him, and as he passed by, they yelled and beckoned at whoever happened to be behind him, man, woman, or child. Jack gaped frankly at the wares scattered all around him, wares both wonderful and strange, and amidst all the others staring at them, he ceased to be a stranger himself, perhaps because he had given up his effort to seem blasé in a place where no one acted blasé. They laughed, they argued, they haggled, but no one seemed bored. The market town reminded him of the Queen's Pavilion without the air of strained tension and too hectic gaiety. There was the same absurdly rich mingle of smells dominated by roasting meat and animal ordure, the same brightly dressed crowds, although even the most brightly dressed people Jack saw couldn't hold a candle to some of the dandies he had seen inside the pavilion, the same unsettling but somehow exhilarating juxtaposition of the perfectly normal cheek by jowl with the extravagantly strange. He stopped at a stall where a man was selling carpets with the Queen's portrait woven into them. Jack suddenly thought of Hank Scoffler's mom and smiled. Hank was one of the kids Jack and Richard Sloat had hung around with in L.A. Mrs. Scoffler had a thing for the most garish decorations Jack had ever seen. And God, wouldn't she have loved these rugs, with the image of Laura DeLoessian, her hair done up in a high, regal coronet of braids woven into them, better than her velvet paintings of Alaskan stags, or the ceramic diorama of the Last Supper behind the bar in the Scoffler living room. Then the face, woven into the rugs, seemed to change, even as he looked at it. The face of the Queen was gone, and it was his mother's face he saw, repeated over and over and over, her eyes too dark, her skin much too white. Homesickness surprised Jack again. It rushed through his mind in a wave, and he called out for her in his heart, "Mom! Hey, Mom! Jesus, what am I doing here, Mom?" Wondering with a lover's longing intensity what she was doing now, right this minute. Sitting at the window, smoking, looking out at the ocean, a book open beside her, watching TV, at a movie, sleeping, dying. "Dead," an evil voice added before he could stop it. "Dead, Jack? Already dead? Stop it." He felt the burning sting of tears. "Why so sad, my little lad?" He looked up, startled, and saw the rug salesman looking at him. He was as big as the meat vendor, and his arms were also tattooed, but his smile was open and sunny. There was no meanness in it. That was a big difference. "It's nothing," Jack said.
"If it's nothing makes you look like that, you ought to be thinking of something, my son, my son."
"I looked that bad, did I?" Jack asked, smiling a little. He had also grown unselfconscious about his speech, at least for the moment, and perhaps that was why the rug salesman heard nothing odd or off-rhythm in it.
"Laddie, you looked as if you only had one friend left on this side of the moon, and you just saw the wild white wolf come out of the north and gobble him down with a silver spoon."
Jack smiled a little. The rug salesman turned away and took something from a smaller display to the right of the largest rug. It was oval and had a short handle. As he turned it over, the sun flashed across it. It was a mirror. To Jack it looked small and cheap, the sort of thing you might get for knocking over all 3 wooden milk bottles in a carnival game.
"Here, laddie," the rug salesman said, "take a look and see if I'm not right."
Jack looked into the mirror and gaped. For a moment so stunned he thought his heart must have forgotten to beat. It was him, but he looked like something from Pleasure Island in the Disney version of Pinocchio, where too much pool shooting and cigar smoking had turned boys into donkeys. His eyes, normally as blue and round as an Anglo-Saxon heritage could make them, had gone brown and almond-shaped. His hair, coarsely matted and falling across the middle of his forehead, had a definite mane-like look. He raised one hand to brush it away and touched only bare skin. In the mirror, his fingers seemed to fade right through the hair. He heard the vendor laugh, pleased. Most amazing of all, long jackass ears dangled down to below his jawline. As he stared, one of them twitched. He thought suddenly, I had one of these. And on the heels of that, in the daydreams I had one of these. Back in the regular world, it was... He could have been no more than four. In the regular world, he had stopped thinking of it as the real world without even noticing. It had been a great big glass marble with a rosy center. One day, while he was playing with it, it had rolled down the cement path in front of their house, and before he could catch it, it had fallen down a sewer grate. It had been gone, forever, he had thought then, sitting on the curb with his face propped on his dirty hands and weeping. But it wasn't. Here was that old toy rediscovered, just as wonderful now as it had been when he was three or four. He grinned, delighted. The image changed, and Jack the Jackass became Jack the Cat, his face wise and secret with amusement. His eyes went from donkey brown to tomcat green. Now pert little gray-furred ears cocked alertly where the droopy donkey ears had dangled. "Better," the vendor said. "Better, my son. I like to see a happy boy. A happy boy is a healthy boy, and a healthy boy finds his way in the world. Book of Good Farming says that, and if it doesn't, it should. I may just scratch it in my copy, if I ever scratch up enough scratch from my pumpkin patch to buy a copy someday. Want the glass?" "Yes," Jack cried. "Yeah, great." He groped for his sticks. Frugality was forgotten. "How much?" The vendor frowned and looked around swiftly to see if they were being watched. "Put it away, my son. Tuck it down deep, that's the way. You show your scratch, you're apt to lose the batch. Dips abound on market ground." "What? Never mind. No charge. Take it. Half of 'em get broken in the back of my wagon when I drag 'em back to my store come 10 months. Mothers bring their little uns over and they try it, but they don't buy it." "Well, at least you don't deny it," Jack said. The vendor looked at him with some surprise, and then they both burst out laughing. "A happy boy with a snappy mouth," the vendor said. "Come see me when you're older and bolder, my son. We'll take your mouth and head south and treble what we peddle." Jack giggled. This guy was better than a rap record by the Sugar Hill Gang. "Thanks," he said. A large, improbable grin had appeared on the chops of the cat in the mirror. "Thanks very much." "Thank me to God," the vendor said. Then, as an afterthought, "and watch your wad." Jack moved on, tucking the mirror toy carefully into his jerkin next to Speedy's bottle. And every few minutes he checked to make sure his sticks were still there. He guessed he knew what dips were, after all. Two stalls down from the booth of the rhyming rug vendor, a depraved-looking man with a patch askew over one eye and the smell of strong drink about him, was trying to sell a farmer a large rooster. He was telling the farmer that if he bought this rooster and put it in with his hens, the farmer would have nothing but double yokers for the next 12 months. Jack, however, had neither eyes for the rooster nor ears for the salesman's pitch. He joined a crowd of children who were staring at the one-eyed man's star attraction. This was a parrot in a large wicker cage. It was almost as tall as the youngest children in the group, and it was as smoothly, darkly green as a Heineken beer bottle. Its eyes were a brilliant gold. Its four eyes. Like the pony he had seen in the pavilion stables, the parrot had two heads. It gripped its perch with its big yellow feet and looked placidly in two directions at once, its two tufted crowns almost touching. The parrot was talking to itself to the amusement of the children, but even in his amazement, Jack noted that while they were paying close attention to the parrot, they seemed neither stunned nor even very wondering. They weren't like kids seeing their first movie, sitting stupefied in their seats and all eyes. They were more like kids getting their regular Saturday morning cartoon fix. This was a wonder, yes, but not a wholly new one. And to whom do wonders pall more rapidly than the very young?
"Brock!"
"How high is up?" Easthead inquired.
"As low as low," Westhead responded, and the children giggled.
"Crack! What's the great truth of noblemen?" Easthead now asked.
"That a king will be a king all his life, but once a night's enough for any man," Westhead replied pertly.
Jack smiled, and several of the older children laughed, but the younger ones only looked puzzled.
"And what's in Mrs. Pratt's cupboard?" Easthead now posed.
"A sight no man shall see," Westhead rejoined,
and although Jack was mystified, the children went into gales of laughter. The parrot solemnly shifted its talons on its perch and made droppings into the straw below it.
"And what frightened Alan Destry to death in the night?"
"He saw his wife, Grok, getting out of the bath."
The farmer was now walking away, and the one-eyed salesman still had charge of the rooster. He rounded furiously on the children.
"Get out of here! Get out of here before I kick your asses square!"
The children scattered. Jack went with them, sparing a last bemused look over his shoulder at the wonderful parrot. At another stall, he gave up 2 knuckles of wood for an apple and a dipper of milk, the sweetest, richest milk he had ever tasted. Jack thought that if they had milk like that back at home, Nestle's and Hershey's would go bankrupt in a week. He was just finishing the milk when he saw the Henry family moving slowly in his direction. He handed the dipper back to the woman in the stall, who poured the lees thriftily back into the large wooden cask beside her. Jack hurried on, wiping a milk mustache from his upper lip, and hoping uneasily that no one who had drunk from the dipper before him had had leprosy or herpes or anything like that. But he somehow didn't think such awful things even existed over here. He walked up the market town's main thoroughfare, past the mimers, past 2 fat women selling pots and pans, territory's Tupperware, Jack thought, and grinned, past that wonderful 2-headed parrot— its one-eyed owner was now drinking quite openly from a clay bottle, reeling wildly from one end of his booth to the other, holding the dazed-looking rooster by the neck and yelling truculently at passers-by. Jack saw the man's scrawny right arm was caked with yellowish-white guano and grimaced. Past an open area where farmers were gathered, he paused there for a moment, curious. Many of the farmers were smoking clay pipes, and Jack saw several clay bottles, much the same as the one the bird salesman had been brandishing, go from hand to hand. In a long grassy field, men were hitching stones behind large shaggy horses with lowered heads and mild, stupid eyes. Jack passed the rug stall. The vendor saw him and raised a hand. Jack raised one in turn and thought of calling, "Use it, my man, but don't abuse it." He decided he better not. He was suddenly aware that he felt blue. That feeling of strangeness, of being an outsider, had fallen over him again. He reached the crossroads. The way going north and south was little more than a country lane. The western road was much wider. "Old Travelin' Jack," he thought, and tried to smile. He straightened his shoulders and heard Speedy's bottle clink lightly against the mirror. "Here goes old Travelin' Jack along the territory's version of Interstate 90. Feats don't fail me now." He set off again, and soon that great, dreaming land swallowed him. About 4 hours later, in the middle of the afternoon, Jack sat down in the tall grass by the side of the road and watched as a number of men, from this distance they looked little bigger than bugs, climbed a tall, rickety-looking tower. He had chosen this place to rest and eat his apple because it was here that the western road seemed to make its closest approach to that tower. It was still at least 3 miles away, and perhaps much more than that. The almost supernatural clarity of the air made distances extremely hard to judge. But it had been in Jack's view for an hour or more. Jack ate his apple, rested his tired feet, and wondered what that tower could be, standing out there all by itself in a field of rolling grass. And, of course, he wondered why those men should be climbing it. The wind had blown quite steadily ever since he had left the market town, and the tower was downwind of Jack, but whenever it died away for a minute, Jack could hear them calling to each other, and laughing. There was a lot of laughing going on. Some 5 miles west of the market, Jack had walked through a village, if your definition of a village stretched to cover 5 tiny houses and 1 store that had obviously been closed for a long time. Those had been the last human habitations he had seen between then and now. Just before glimpsing the tower, he had been wondering if he had already come to the outposts without